KALW.
A lot of people kind of assume that if you got the average Republican to like the average Democratic citizen more, that would then change how they vote or what they want politicians to do.
With today's charged political environment, we ask, how can people better understand each other?
I think what our research suggests is that maybe we can't actually take that for granted.
We'll hear about new research from UC Berkeley. Then actress Lou Nell tells us about the career dream she's working to make a reality, her journey from Oakland to Hollywood.
I would love to be the next Black female in Late Night. I've certainly been trained for it by the experiences that I had at SOBE Television Network.
And three Bay Area authors read from their books of nonfiction. Writers Niraja Viswanathan, Gabriella Hasbun, and Misasha Zuki Graham. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. We may not always feel it here in the Bay Area, but political polarization in the U.S. is on the rise. Studies say divides between liberals and conservatives are getting deeper, and a recent Pew Research poll found 60% of Americans say having conversations with people they disagree with is stressful and frustrating. So then, how do you begin to bridge those divides in this current climate? That's what UC Berkeley political science researcher Dave Brockman looked at in his latest study. He says communication is key, but the kind of communication can make a difference. I spoke with Brockman to learn more about his research.
So we did two studies, and the first study we did was, in some ways, I think the most kind of basic thing, which is actually not to have folks talk about politics at all, but just to have them talk about something that, based on prior psychology research, you'd expect a conversation to go really well. So I think essentially this was kind of like the easiest thing. And in particular, what we used is something psychologists call the fast friends paradigm, where you have people talk about their perfect day. So, right, super positive conversation, you're dwelling on something nice. And it turns out a lot of people, when they talk about pleasant things, other people also like those things. So it's research shows it's a great way to... Yeah, it's a great way to build kind of feelings of, you know, similarity. So if you have two groups that see themselves as really dissimilar, if you can say, well, let's talk about our perfect day, then a lot of, you know, similarity is going to come up. It's going to be a pleasant conversation.
Okay.
And so we thought, okay, that's about probably as positive as a conversation can go. And what we did is just randomly assigned whether they were going to know that the person they were talking about their perfect day with was of the other party or not. So if I was a Republican in the study, I'd always be talking to a Democrat, but sometimes I would have no idea. So I'm just talking to another person about my perfect day, doing some questions. But sometimes I'd be told, hey, by the way, you're about to talk to a Democrat. And in that study, we followed up with a bunch of measures to look at, well, what kinds of effects do those conversations then have, both in the short term and in the long term?
And then the other experiment, which was not about a perfect day, what were the questions there?
People talked about politics. In a particular, one condition we called in-party strength. And this is where we asked people to talk about why they like their own party. And then we also had another condition, which is to have people talk about why they don't like the other party. Mm. And so if I was a Republican, I would say, hey, here's why I'm not a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about findings then. What did you find in terms of that first benign, pleasant question about what your perfect day is like?
Yeah. So I think it's depending on how you want to think about it, it's a little bit of either like a glass half empty or glass half full situation. You know, I'll let you and your listeners decide. So the glass half full part is that consistent with the promise of cross-partisan conversations, we found really, really large effects on people feeling much more positively towards the other party when we measure that right away. So if you have this pleasant conversation with someone who's a member of the other political party, and then I ask you a few minutes later, well, how do you feel about members of the other political party? People were much, much more positive. With the participants' consent, we recorded the audio from all the conversations. And just reviewing some of the transcripts, you know, the vast majority, if not almost all of these conversations, including the political ones later, by the way, tend to be very polite and pleasant, right? So I think, you know, we have the sense of from the people who argue over Facebook. And I think in part that's the medium of, you know, text message, you know, being things in text and in public with other people watching, and in part because of, you know, the kinds of people that post political comments about Facebook. I think we have a sense that the other party is going to be, you know, really impolite or whatever, but really we didn't find that at all. You know, people are very pleasant to each other and they generally respect each other's differences. And I think that surprises people. So I think those are two really encouraging findings, is that we do see some evidence that at least right away, people like the other party a lot more than they did before. And they think that the other party respects them. That's the glass half full part though.
Okay. What about the other side?
Although we see really big differences in how likely people are to say they have a positive view towards voters of the other party, they're actually not any more likely to say that they would behave differently politically. So all of a sudden, if I'm the Republican in this study, then I'm more likely to say, oh yeah, like Democratic voters are really nice, they respect me. But then when we ask them questions like, well, how much do you think Republicans in Congress should be cooperating with Democrats in Congress? Or would you be willing to vote for a Democrat? Or do you think it's important for Democrats and Republicans to talk? Or how do you feel about Democratic politicians? Or do you want to, you know, subscribe to a newsletter where you get information about, you know, that's a little more balanced? You know, any of these kinds of outcomes related to how people would vote or the information they consume, things more about politics itself, it's basically just zeros across the board.
Zero. So it's more of that personal, you know, small scale, one-on-one feelings that change, but then large scale political arena issue, you know, feelings do not.
I think there's a kind of maybe commonsensical view out there that I think a lot of people kind of assume that if you got, say, the average Republican to like the average Democrat, a Democratic person, citizen more, that would then change, you know, how they vote or what they want politicians to do.
Right.
And a lot of these different kind of approaches to try to get Democrats and Republicans to talk are based on that idea. And I think what our research suggests that maybe we can't actually take that for granted. That when we get people to like the other party more, it's not clear that translates into differences in political behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think if we all introspect as people, then, you know, that might seem a little less surprising it does at first, right? If I think about my political views, the parties that I, and politicians that I vote for, if I just liked the people that had views opposite mine more, that's not going to necessarily make me more willing to then vote for the politicians they vote for, because I vote for the politicians I vote for based on, you know, other considerations than that.
You know, I read that you also said person-to-person engagements that were more extensive, you know, they were longer term, rather than, you know, quick little one-offs, make a bigger difference in not really changing anybody's minds. Because, I mean, if we're being honest, it's hard to change people's minds. So for me, it's about how about having a civil conversation where at least people understand each other. And it seems that that's something that you've said as well, which is, you know, that differences of opinion, they aren't themselves necessarily a problem, but people need to be able to discuss them.
I do think one thing that we do need voters to be able to do sometimes in a democracy is to be able to deliberate about problems and solutions with other people. I think that's really especially true at the local level. If you think about here in the Bay Area, for example, you know, there's so many important issues we face, be it on, you know, housing, homelessness, whatever else, where a lot of those decisions are really, you know, neighborhood level decisions about, you know, do we want to, for example, welcome new neighbors? What do we think about crime in our neighborhood? And, you know, reports that's increasing. What solutions do we want in, you know, this neighborhood or, you know, our city? And those are the kinds of issues that I really do think we have a lot of. There's a lot of headway to be made still to try to help equip people of how do you approach those conversations in a way that will lead people to be more willing to compromise, be more willing to see the other side's perspective. And so I think that's there's some, I think, common sense things that prior research has suggested, but I think that's an area that we need to learn a lot more about. And I do think is very important.
Thank you, Professor Brockman.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
That's UC Berkeley political science researcher Dave Brockman. His latest study is in the journal Science. You can hear the rest of my conversation with him online at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Before making it in Hollywood, comedian and actress Lunell got her start on stages here in the Bay Area. She grew up in Oakland. She got her start as a regular host on Soul Beat, the nation's first Black-owned cable TV network. And she's been in big films like Dolomite Is My Name, A Star Is Born, and Borat. Now she has dreams of a late-night talk show. Lunell spoke with KALW's Janae Darden about her journey to Hollywood.
Miss Lunell, welcome.
Hello.
I've been wanting to talk to you for so long. Thank you so much, because I know you are a busy lady. So the fact that I was able to get you, thank you so much.
Yeah, there's no problem.
Okay, so I grew up in East Oakland. So I grew up watching you. I understand you started off doing theater. And like I said, I grew up watching you on Soul Beat, cable station Soul Beat. How'd you make the jump from theater to Soul Beat?
Well, I got the bug. Because I went to a play at the Oakland Ensemble Theater, which used to be on 13th and Grove, was what they called it then. And it was opening night. My girlfriend's sister was in a play, and we got to go backstage, and I saw the ropes and the curtains and the wardrobe. Then we went to the opening night festivities reception, and everybody was taking pictures and signing autographs and eating finger foods and drinking champagne. And I said, well, I don't know what this is, but I want to do this. I did two films in Oakland as well. Oakland is where I got my SAG card because I got cast on a fluke in Mike Myers' first movie, which was called So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Before he ever did any Austin Powers or anything like that. And then the next movie was The Rock with Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage. That's the movie that I got my Screen Actors Guild card on. Chuck Johnson, I'm skipping a little around.
No,
a little
that's
bit,
fine. But Chuck Johnson founded Soul Beat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started to do some comedy. And I think I got on Chuck Johnson, the owner, operator, founder of the Soul Beat television network, all Black owned and operated network before BET, actually. And it was in Oakland. Right. He got in touch with me, recruited me to start doing some commercials for the station, and the station was, pretty poor back in the day and had equipment. It wasn't always the best. And the commercials were, pretty self-contained, written and executed by just locals and stuff. So I started doing some commercials for him and they got pretty popular. And then he asked me to maybe host this show or that show. And I got even more popular and started hosting a morning show. And I just became really, really popular.
I remember you on all the time. I would watch you in the morning sometime and I would watch you after school.
At night sometime, yeah. I was on a lot. It was my life for a while, but it was a good life because it gave me access to a lot of things in Oakland. It gave me a lot of hookups and I made a lot of friends. I got very popular. So that's why LA has not fazed me in the popularity vein because I signed autographs and took pictures and everything like that before I even left Oakland. So when I got to LA, it wasn't like I got mind blown with that or anything like that. And it took a while to get to that stage here in Los Angeles.
I've heard from you following you on social media, you have late night talk show host dreams.
Yes, I would love to be the next Black female in late night. I think that there is a definite place for female in late night and a Black one at that and me. not just because you're Black and just because you're female. I think that I'm cut out for late night. I've certainly been trained for it by the experiences that I had at SoBe Television Network. And during the quarantine, I created a YouTube show called Hey Lunell that is on YouTube. There's 62 episodes up. I had to stop when I went on tour because I just simply couldn't keep up with it. I may bring it back. We still try to post content on there. Of course, I was very opinionated. And I want to be the next Black female on late night because they've had a few Black females in late night, but I just feel like they haven't had the right one. I feel like I'm a good fit for it. And I want it to be different, not the same old Johnny Carson cookie cutter, walk out, do a monologue, sit down, interview the guests, sell the soap powder. I don't want to do it like that. I have my own ideas, which of course I have refurbished from some other things that I've seen. And I just, you know, if you're up late or you come in from work, all you're going to see is white man after white man after white man after white man on late night. And they've got enough, like, share the wealth, you know. There just needs to be some diversity late night. And I want to be one of the people to crack that door open.
Lunell, I have really enjoyed following your rise in star power. You just really, over the years, you've blown up. You've been in movies with Eddie Murphy. You were in A Star is Born. You performed at the Hollywood Bowl. You had a residency in Vegas. You got other stuff coming up. Some people have said you were underrated. You know, do you feel like you were underrated? And do you feel like you're now getting the attention you deserve?
Yes, I feel a little underrated. I feel like I'm getting more on people's radar. 30 years in, you know, it's about time. I haven't changed my style or perspective in all this time. The times have changed, so maybe people can accept me a little bit more these days than they could in the past. And I'm working on producing some stuff and writing some stuff and, you know, also campaigning for my late night show. And I'm also on this HBO Max series called Hacks that stars Jean Smart. I've done a vast array of films that cross all ethnic
cultures,
groups. True. You know, from Borat to Think Like a Man 1 and 2 to voiceover in Hotel Transylvania or in Boondocks. So I think that I'm getting my just due now, but there's a lot more territory for me to cover, a lot more money to be made.
That was Oakland actress and comedian Lunell speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. If you want to hear more of that conversation, there will be an online half-hour special tomorrow. You can find it at KALW.org. You can also check out Lunell's work in her new movie, Block Party, and watch her in the latest season of the HBO series, Hacks. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, three nonfiction authors share their work in this collection from KALW's literary podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Today, we'll hear readings from three nonfiction books, and their topics are so different, they really show the breadth of the genre from local writers. Oakland-based author Niraja Viswanathan writes the series Infamous Women of History. Volume 2 came out in December of 2021.
It includes the Deadly Spinster, the Vampire Countess, and the Dragon Lady. The series is a look at historical women with such bad reputations that they became iconic representations of feminine evil. Here's an excerpt. Spinster and axe murderess, countess and sadist, empress and schemer. Though they don't appear to have much in common at first glance, each woman in this book has two reputations. Lizzie Borden was a prim New England spinster, but also believed to have butchered her parents with a hatchet. Countess Elizabeth Báthory was revered for her ancient lineage and impeccable conduct, but remembered as a sadist who bathed in the blood of tortured virgins. And the Empress Dowager Cixi shocked 19th century China by rising from concubine to ruler, but history labels her as a xenophobe and plotter who slept and poisoned her way to power. All three women have been condemned in the court of public opinion for the evil they supposedly represent and for crossing the boundaries of what was considered proper for a woman according to the mostly male standards of the time.
That was Niraja Viswanathan reading from Infamous Women of History. Okay, for our next book, we're going to stick to the topic of women, but bring it up to the present day. Misasha Suzuki Graham lives in San Carlos. She and Sarah Blanchard wrote the book Dear White Women, which came out in October of 2021.
It's about answering the question, well, what do I do when it comes to being more anti-racist in your everyday life? And here's one of my favorite parts. Recently, I was asked about my name and its connection to my identity. As you can imagine, when your parents give you a name they made up, you face a lifetime of answering questions about it, on a good day, or defending your right to be called what you would like to be called, rather than whatever name, or combination of syllables, or shortened version, makes the person asking feel more comfortable, on a bad day. As a result, I've thought a lot about my name and what's in a name. So this time when I was asked, I didn't even hesitate before I said, my name is a perfect representation of who I am. Here's why.
That was Misasha Suzuki Graham reading from Dear White Women. Our last book today also addresses history and identity. Gabriella Hasbun is a San Francisco-based photographer. Her book, The New Black West, came out at the end of April 2022.
The book is about the Black cowboys I've met at the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo. The Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo was founded in 1984 by Lou Vasson, and to this day, it remains the nation's only touring Black rodeo. A hairstylist, concert producer, and promoter, Vasson became interested in rodeos while attending the granddaddy of them all, the Cheyenne Frontier Days Rodeo in Wyoming. He quickly realized that there were no Black cowboys participating in that legendary production. On his return to Denver, where he resided in the 1980s, he began his research at the Black American West Museum, exploring the history of Black cowboys, the contributions of African American settlers, and the opening of the Western frontier. After more than 2 years of research and fundraising, Vasson produced the inaugural Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo in Denver, Colorado. This heritage rodeo helps educate people from all over the world about the rich history of Black cowboys and cowgirls, and it highlights their overlooked contributions to the American rodeo culture.
That was Gabriella Hasbun reading from The New Black West.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can hear more at kalw.org/newarrivals. Today's Cross Currents team includes Henija Herjani, Sebastian Minio Buccelli, Sunday Holland, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Shaya Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.